Welcome to History 101. Lecture 24. The Development of Underdevelopment. As I said, the literature on empire and world history has partly been a useful departure, as it had broadened debates on imperialism and colonialism to foster less exclusively on the 1880 to 1914 period that historians conventionally designated as the age of modern imperialism. For certainly in the British case, rather than that the 80s suddenly featured an outbreak of colonial enthusiasm, whereas the British had before been averse from acquiring any colonial territory, the British Empire had in fact steadily expanded throughout the 19th century. That is even the case in North America, where the British in 1800 really only possessed the area round the St. Lawrence River and a small trapper station in Vancouver Bay, and all the rest of the vast hinterland was barely known, barring a few scattered trade posts of the Hudson Bay Company in the interior. While with the joining of the Pacific territories and the government of Canada buying the territorial claims of the Hudson Bay Company in the 1860s, Canada had by 1900 become a large territorial empire of its own. Arguably, the British only became interested in Africa when they had already obtained the plum of that magnificent colonial cake, as they used to say back then. It certainly appeared so to the Germans, who constantly complained that their entire colonial empire, which they had obtained during the colonial scramble, was little more than its offal. The tropical swamps of New Guinea, the Kalahari Desert, the barren Bismarck Archipelago, and the savannah of German Southeast Africa, nowadays Tanzania. They were all virtually useless, and they cost far more than they ever would bring in. Well, the only two useful, profitable territories they had were mere post stamps on the map, Tiny Togo, and the small enclave of the port of Qingdao, China. What was all that compared to India, to Australia, to Canada, or to South Africa, that the British had all acquired before the colonial scramble? Historian Friedrich Meinecke recalled the days of his youth in the 90s of the 19th century as follows, quote, "As it then appeared to us youngsters, at that time a German nation, squeezed into a, for her further growth, much too small space, had inevitably to come to the idea it needed a vast colonial empire to assure its very existence as a nation. Yet Germany, we felt deeply and spitefully, had come too late, as the world was divided, while England was basking in good fortune, and was everywhere trying to push us aside with its broad shoulders. Yet, if all that is true, the literature on empires in world history hazards losing sight of what was genuinely new to the colonial empires of the 19th century, the modern state and capitalism. For there was a close relationship between the rule by the bourgeoisie and modern imperialism that the literature on empires in world history manages to effectively obscure by linking the British Empire to such very non-capitalist constructs as the Assyrian or Alexander the Great's empire. As socialist writer Robert Morris described the internal impetus of both 19th century capitalism and imperialism in his utopian novel News from Nowhere from 1890, as he looked back from the perspective of an imagined late 20th century into the late 19th world. It is clear from all that we hear and read that in the last age of civilization, man had got into a vicious circle in the matter of production of wares. They had reached a wonderful facility of production, and in order to make the most of that facility, they had gradually created, or allowed to grow, rather, a most elaborate system of buying and selling, which they called the world market. And that world market, once set going, forced them to go on making more and more of those wares, whether they needed them or not, so that while they could not free themselves from the toil of making real necessities, they created an ever-ending series sham or artificial necessities, which became, under the iron rule of the world markets, of equal importance to them with the real necessities that supported life. By all this, they burdened themselves with a prodigious mass of work, and that merely for the sake of keeping their wretched system going. The appetite of that world market grew with what it fed on, the countries within the ring of civilization, that is, organized misery, were cluttered with the abortions of the market, and force and fraud were used unsparingly to open up countries outside that pale. This process of opening up is a strange one to those who have read the professions of the men of that period and do not understand the practice, and perhaps shows us, at its very worst, the great vice of the 19th century, the use of hypocrisy to evade the responsibility of vicarious ferocity. When the civilized markets coveted a country not yet in its clutches, some transparent pretext was found, the suppression of a slavery different from and not so cruel as that of two commoners, the pushing of a religion no longer believed in by its own promoters, or the rescue of some desperado or homicidal madman whose misdeeds had got him into trouble amongst the natives of that barbarous country, any stick in short which could beat the dog at all. Then some bold, unprincipled, ignorant adventurer was found, and he was bribed to create a market by breaking up whatever traditional society there might be in the doomed country, and destroying whatever leisure or pleasure he found there. He forced wares on the natives, which they did not want, and took their natural products in exchange, as this form of robbery was called. And thereby he created new ones, to supply which, that is, to be allowed to live by their new masters, the hapless, helpless people had to sell themselves into the slavery of hopeless toil, so that they might have something wherewith to purchase the nullities of civilization. As an example, the German Empire handed its local African diplomacy to a private company, so-called Gesellschaft für Deutsche Kolonisation, so that if it came to clashes with the French or the British, the German government might always claim it knew nothing about it. That Gesellschaft was headed by one of those bold adventurers, or rather homicidal madmen, philosophy teacher and Arthur Schopenhauer adept, though admittedly Schopenhauer was not a very pleasant character himself, Karl Peter, on whom one of his companions wrote, quote, "Everything Peter does is utterly crazy. Everybody around him is bending under his lashes, 100 or 150 every day. It is hardly credible how afraid his own people are for him. While the Social Democratic journal Voorwaarts remarked on Peters, quote, "He is a grim Aryan who would most like to exterminate the Jewish race. And lacking Jews, he seeks his recourse in Africa in order to shoot Negroes for fun there or hanging Negro girls after he has satisfied his animal lusts with them." For Peters was not merely accused but proven to have hanged his own lover. Small wonder, Peters was during the Nazi period hailed as a great original proponent of the National Socialist idea, or that, once ubiquitous streets named Karl Peterstraße have silently been renamed to something or someone else in the Federal Republic of Germany. Traditionally, the historians worked with broadly a threefold division of colonialism in the 19th century. Old imperialism, the imperialism of free trade, and new imperialism from 1800 to 1914, and in my view up to 1939. First came, though few historians of new imperialism have given much thought on what old imperialism precisely entailed, the age of old imperialism, one that runs roughly stretched from either the Battle of Buxar to the 1830s, or from the collapse of the first, the America-centered British Empire with the Peace of Paris, and the simultaneous growth of the second British Empire in India onto the 30s. Though there was general colonial gloom in Britain after the Peace of Paris. And it is often argued, historian Edward Gibbon wrote his Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire with the British Empire in mind, as he expected the same to happen to it soon, as the Abbé Raynal in retrospect rightly underlined. What did the loss of North America matter to the British, if with India they now had territories infinitely larger and infinitely richer than all of those North American colonies? And furthermore, the British could now foster their entire navy and military on India, rather than having to scatter it all over North America, the Caribbean, India, and Europe. So the focus of British colonial policy increasingly shifted from the Americas to Asia. Though Canada, that the British had, as I said, acquired only reluctantly, admittedly became of steadily increasing economic importance to Britain, not only due to emigration, but also, as with the construction of the Canadian Pacific Railway in 1871, the vast plains of the Canadian prairie were opened, and the British came increasingly to rely on imports of Canadian grain instead of American, as that, obviously, could be paid in sterling, and the British had a heavy deficit on the balance of payments with the USA. Yet, despite the increasing importance of Canada, that indeed has attracted more British capital per capita than any other area in the world, by 1800, British colonial expansion still increasingly fostered on the tropical colonies, and in particular India became the famous jewel in the crown. So India had to be defended at all costs by what the soldiers always called securing the clay kiss, that is a defensive mode or outwork that they consecutively defined ever broader. Now, this old imperialism was still led by the old monopoly companies, the East India Company, the Royal Africa Company, and for the Dutch, and in a modest way the Portuguese, whose old territory of Goa doubled in size in the 18th century with the addition of the so-called new conquest round Goa, the Dutch and the new Portuguese East India Company. One objective of the company's expansion was, as I said, to secure a monopoly on profitable trade goods for Europe, and the East India Companies also increasingly functioned as a kind of protective screen for British, Dutch or Portuguese private traders, providing the diplomatic and military protection to them without which they could not function, as well as the basis for their supplies, such as Fort Cornwallis at Penang in Malacca Strait, founded by Country Captain Francis Light in 1783, and that was very much intended as a competitor to Dutch-controlled Malacca. Then there was Aden, that was secured by the government of India in 1839, very much in order to strangle the trade of the old hunter-bull of the Red Sea, Mohammed. Such country trade was in turn increasingly financed and arranged by what the British called agency houses. For as officials of the company Asia, they commonly sent part of their fortune back home in the forms of bills of exchange, and part they would entrust to local European firms that financed their trading ventures within Asia, such as the firm of James Matheson and William Jardine, who specialized on country trade between India and China. That meant trade in opium, strictly prohibited in China, so they had high returns and always scrupulously paid high dividends to their former employees, the company in, say, Grosvenor Square, London, or country houses in North Devon. Yet they had to work in China under that annoying supervision of Chinese officials, so that Jardine pleaded to Foreign Secretary Lord Palmerston some remote offshore island should be secured out of sight of any of these hop-pole, and where the British could then safely ply their drugs. And he already fixed on the place too. It was conveniently close to Guangdong and was called Hong Kong. And finally, the East India companies also increasingly provided a protective cover for European banks, which provided ever larger loans to such Indian princes as the Nawab of Tanjore or Hyderabad or the Nawab of Awadh at outrageous interest rates. These banks were obviously assured that should they come into difficulties, they would be bailed out by His Majesty's redcoats as the settlers were. Whereas these princes were almost habitually in severe financial difficulties, as the British used to station most of their troops in their territory, for which they then had to cough up the costs. And securing the credit of bankers became paramount to British expansion in the 19th century as well, and even more so. For, on the one hand, credit markets became for the first time truly global in the 19th century as a new kind of financier appeared. The concession hunter, no longer merely peddling marvelous loans for no interest whatsoever, with, for example, your custom revenues or your right to collect taxes on tobacco as collateral to the government of France, as law had done before, or to the Nizam of Hyderabad, where William Palmer and Co. had in the late 18th century practically pawned the entire kingdom by lending to the Nizam at an 18% rate, that is 6 times what the British state had to pay, but to that of Tunisia, Morocco, Egypt, Iran, Turkey, and indeed China as well. All this then commonly ended in what was at the time called a régie, in which those governments, when they inevitably defaulted on their loans, were put under a, as it were, tutorship of an international commission of bankers, who used a collection of taxes or of custom revenues as collateral. What then obviously happened next was that those states had then, as ever more of their incomes were under such regimes, practically no incomes left. So they inevitably defaulted on their loans again. And in Morocco, Tunisia and Egypt, this ensued in the government being for the time being, the inhabitants were always assured, taken over by an international and impartial committee of bankers, who would bring the finances of the country in order. Yet that obviously entailed that for the time being too, the country had to be run by equally impartial British or French administrators to standardize the tax collection. They would leave as soon as the politicians or statesmen from that country were sufficiently ripe for it. It might, of course, take a long time, but they should be glad with it. For did such enlightened people not know best what was best for the Zulus, or for the Egyptians, or for the Moroccans, or for the Chinese? After all, as Minister of Colonies Arthur James Balfour classically put it in 1906, quote, "I will take up no attitude of superiority, but I ask anyone who has even the most superficial knowledge of history if they will look in the face the facts with which a British statesman has to deal when he is put in a position of supremacy over great races like the inhabitants of Egypt and countries in the East. Is it a good thing for these great nations that an absolute government should be exercised by us? I think it is a good thing. I think that experience shows that they have got under it far better government than in the whole history of the world. A government which is not only a benefit to them, but a benefit to the whole of the civilized West as well. We are in Egypt not merely for the sake of the Egyptians, though we are there for their sake. We are there also for the sake of Europe at large. To be more explicit, in dealing with Egyptians or Indians or Zulus, the first question is not to consider what these people, who are all, nationally speaking, more or less in the state of children placed under a curator, themselves think is best in their interest, though this is a point which deserves serious consideration, as rather that each special issue should be decided mainly with reference to what, by the light of Western knowledge and experience, tempered by local considerations, we think is best for the subject race, without reference, Balfour added, to, as is more frequently the case, the special interests represented by some or more influential classes of Englishmen. Where, of course, the liberal Balfour, with the latter phrase, meant those British bankers, from whose tender attentions it was the sacred duty of the British administration to spare the Egyptians. And if for the time being the Egyptians, or indeed the Orientals at large, whom even Balfour conceded had a great history and civilization, had to be put under a tutor, that was obviously double true for such primitives in the Akan of the time as the Zulus or the Ashanti. But aside from this global expansion of state finances, bankers were also pretty much the ruling elite in Britain. A country dominated by what historians Peter Kane and Anthony Hopkins call gentleman capitalists, a joint coterie of bankers and nobles, deriving their revenues from stocks in banks and merchants. Whereas the industrial bourgeoisie remained to them always pretty much a bunch of upstarts. And for those noble bondholders, maintaining their steady returns on investments was the prime responsibility of the government of the British Empire. Though there was, to be sure, a powerful lobby for the Manchester industry in the British Empire as well, as powerful as the West Indian lobby had been in the 18th century. Everybody in both London and Calcutta knew very well the entire tariff policies of British India were dictated by the Chamber of Commerce of Manchester, but everybody was always reluctant to admit so. Yet British colonial policy above all reflected the interests of the City of London and of its ruling classes, if only since most Westminster politicians, and surely the still very aristocratic British diplomats, were commonly married to or were children of bankers. And even if they were not, then the best way to retire for any politician was to secure some sinecure on the board of a bank in the city. Yet maintaining the credit of banks was critical too, as a steady and reliable stream of funds from the colonies became the anchor of the entire British economy by the mid-19th century. As basically the British ran a deficit on their trade with North America, the USA and Canada, with Russia, with Europe, and because of the purchases of grain and beef with South America. And they only had a surplus on trade with the colonies, and with India in particular. So that purchases of grain in the Americas or Argentina were being funded by remittances of bills and of barcode from India to Britain, where India in turn financed its deficit by surpluses in its trade with Europe, the Persian Gulf, and above all to China, which means by and large opium. Those surpluses on the Indian balance of payments thus became the pivot of the central position of the city in international trade, and the city in turn was the pivot of the entire international system of trade and finances. So that, in a way, that entire system rested on the frail backs of peasants in Bihar or Telangana. Such surpluses partly represented purchases of government, which were of course always consigned to British firms, and partly they represented, as I mentioned already, the home charter. In other words, to recall Clive Ponting, as the United Kingdom became industrialized, it began to draw upon raw materials from ecosystems abroad, subjecting them to monocultures, simplification, and deterioration, and that was paid by remittances from India. Now, that old imperialism came gradually to an end in the 1830s, ensuing in a new phase that historian John Gallagher and Ronald Robinson have dubbed imperialism of free trade, and in which the what was now seen as loathsome monopolies of old imperialism were gradually being dismantled to give way to what was known from now on as wholesome free trade. That happened partly on the advice of the new science of the what was then still called political economists, a science, or as you like it, a branch of learning that had become, as one professor of economics already exalted in 1848, the common sense of the entire society, and that Smith, and later on David Ricardo, not proven free trade was always best. From now on, as Keynes classically put it, every living politician would parrot some long-dead economist, whether that be Smith or Ricardo in the 1840s, Marshall in the 1890s, Keynes himself in the 1960s, or Friedman or Mises nowadays. Although, admittedly, the Times could already sigh in 1847, quote, "the science of economy, as expounded by the learned pundits of the day, is a very abstruse and completely arbitrary system that partakes of the mysteriousness of theology and the glorious uncertainty of the law." And that was, of course, exactly why it was so popular then and now. Yet while Keynes was undoubtedly right, the shift to free trade also reflected the main trend in British and indeed in European politics in the 30s, as the new industrial bourgeoisie was admitted into the political process. It began to rally against the navigation laws that were gradually abolished on its urgings in the 40s, or against the tariffs on corn or on sugar. They rallied against the West Indian interest, but they rallied against the monopoly of the East India Company on trade in particular. That was finally rescinded in 1833. It was a difficult battle, for on the one hand, while in the 18th century the East India Company had, with all its wars, booked severe losses, in the early 19th century the company had booked healthy profits. profits that it directly paid into the British Exchequer and that, as I said, were a major factor in the British victory over Napoleon. And on the other hand, the 3,000 shares of the East India Company were an assured source of income for Britain's landed gentry by the early 19th century. For the three traders argued that if wisely ruled, India would yield raw materials capable of fueling the industries in Britain and become a profitable market for British manufacturers besides. And they further sermoned that the true interest of India were agricultural rather than mechanical or manufacturing. It was, after all, a very dangerous potential competitor for the simple reason that cotton grew in India and not in Lancashire. So that the government should do anything to inhibit export of Indian manufactured goods and should promote the export of raw cotton rather than textiles made of cotton to Lancashire. Whence they insisted too that the Raj build a system of railroads to facilitate those exports of cotton. In the 30s, the British government then set about implementing all their good advice. And the Raj was converted to the new economic orthodoxy as well, for which it admittedly needed little encouragement, as its college at Haileybury had always been a pulpit for free trade oratory. So Montgomery Martin could testify to a parliamentary committee on the state of manufacturing in India in 1840, quote, "I have been impressed with the conviction that India has suffered most unjustly in her trade, not merely with England, but with all other countries, by reason of the outcry for free trade on the part of England, without permitting India a free trade herself." And he added, "On all articles, except those where we are supplanting the native manufacturers, and consequently we are impoverishing the country, there is decreasing trade." In 1815, he pursued, "Cotton goods exported from India were of the value of 500,000 sterling. In 1832, they were less than 50,000 sterling. In 1815, the cotton goods imported into India from England were of the value of 26,000 sterling. In 1832, they were upwards of 4 million. We have, during the period of a quarter of a century, compelled the Indian territories to receive our manufactures, our woolens, duty-free, and other articles in proportion, while we have continued during that period to levy almost prohibitory duties, or duties varying from 10 to 1,000% upon articles that are produced in our own territories in India. Therefore, the cry that has taken place for free trade with India has been a free trade from this country, not a free trade between India and this country. The decay and destruction of Surat, Dhaka, of Murshidabad, and other places where native manufactures has been carried on is too painful a fact to dwell upon. I do not consider that it has been the fair course of trade. I think it has been the power of the stronger exercised over the weaker." Allowing for the Mickey Mouse figures he is using, economist Paul Baroche estimated that India supplied some 24% of total manufacturing production to the world market immediately before the British takeover of Bengal, which alone may have accounted for 19%, a figure comparable to China's today. And, as I said before, in that period no other producer could compete with Bengal's killer combination of low wages, low taxes, and high skills. By 1900, India supplied less than 3% of manufactured goods, and Bengal less than 1%. There is admittedly a whole school of historians who seek to deny this, either since they deride this view as nationalist rhetoric, or because the deindustrialization was afterwards used as an argument for a protectionist policy in India in the 60s that many economists now deem to have utterly failed. Yet the trend in India was thus still unmistakably the precise reverse of trends in Europe or in the USA. Whereas they were all industrializing, the traditional manufacturers were all in steep decline, whether that be metalwork or shipbuilding or trade. Thus, for example, in 1856, the tonnage of Indian vessels entering the port of Calcutta amounted to 1.2 million tons, and the British was 2.3 million tons. In 1898, it was 100,000 and 7 million. Textile manufacturing was worse hit. Even by the most optimistic calculations, India lost at least 4 million jobs in manufacturing in the beginning of the 19th century. In major manufacturing centers in North India, such as Patna or Gaya, in the beginning of the 19th century, half the population had worked in manufacturing. At the end of it, it was less than 10%. In 1900, 19.6% of the English population worked in manufacturing. In Bengal, now slightly more than 1%. And in England, in 1900, 12% of the population worked in agriculture. In Bengal, that was 90%. And whereas Europe featured rapid urbanization, India rather featured de-urbanization. In the 18th century, probably about 20% of the Indian population had lived in the cities, and Surat, Dhaka, and Hyderabad were amongst the world's biggest. Yet the total urban population had dropped to a mere 8% in 1880. Thus, the population of Surat declined from 500,000 to less than 80,000. That of Dhaka dropped from 1,000,000 to less than 100,000. Hyderabad from 600,000 to 50,000. But above all, that drop applied to what was arguably the grandest architectural ensemble and architectural achievement of the early 19th century. Lucknow. That one stunned British observer described in 1850 as, quote, "a vision of palaces, domes azure and golden, cupolas, colonnades, rising up amidst the calm ocean of the brightest virtue. Look for miles and miles away, and still the ocean spreads, and the spires of the golden towers glitter in the sun." Is this a city in Awad? Is this the capital of a semi-barbarian race, erected by a corrupt and degraded dynasty? I had to rub my eyes time and time over. Yet after the severe fighting during the mutiny of 1857, Lucknow dwindled from 1,000,000 to less than 100,000 people, and to a dreary provincial town in the midst of decaying ruins. As people were thus pushed out of the cities, the countryside did not experience an agricultural revolution as in England, where ever fewer producers raised ever more crops, as rather a trend that American anthropologist Clifford Geertz classically called agrarian involution, that is, an ever-increasing population on an overcrowded land with little scope for employment beyond agriculture. And where the peasants, Kurtz argued, tried to share their poverty as fairly amongst themselves as they could. Though this overcrowding of the countryside went hand in hand with two other trends. First, to cover the most necessary expenses, to eat in years of bread harvests or pay a wedding, peasants put themselves ever more heavily in debt. By 1900, all over India up to half, and in some states a full 80% of peasants were in severe debt. Where the point was that this money was not used productively, as was the case in Europe or in the USA, to improve the land or to buy agricultural implements, as rather to pay off their last debt or for direct consumption. As for these loans, peasants were charged up to 50% interest. Lending to agriculture tended to crowd out all other forms of investment. Whence the common complaint of the British that there appeared to be plenty of capital in India, but that nobody appeared willing to invest it in trade or manufacturing. And thus too, rural moneylenders assuredly made fortunes, but they tended to lay it out in weddings, in mansions, or in hiring servants. As is, for example, the case for the home base of India's traditional Marwari merchant caste, Bikaner, still full of sumptuous 19th century palaces laid out by rich Marwari family. And on the other hand, rural inequality sharply increased, as the British tried to implement that security of property before the law that was one of the central tenets of that liberalism that guided the actions of the British colonial state throughout. That might increase the security of property of an absentee landlord, but decreased the security of his co-sharing tenants. And while more households had security of property, all this went at the expense of the majority of small peasants, who were increasingly demoted to agricultural laborers, on plots that were far too small to feed their families. Consequently, by 1900, 40 million people in India were calculated to be on the verge of starvation. To quote John Hindman, writing in 1904, "The total gross value of all the produce of British India for 225 million human beings cannot be put at more than £1 per head per year. No such dire poverty over so large an area was ever before known on the planet. And that impoverishment is increasing. Mr. Digby, an official of one of the great famine agencies, and with special opportunities for obtaining information, calculated that peasants in districts outside of the permanent settlement area get only one half as much to eat in the year as their grandfather did, and only one third as much as their grand-grandfathers did. Yet, in spite of such facts, the land tax is exacted with the greatest stringency and must be paid to the government in coin before the crops are gathered. Thus, apart from other drawbacks, our system forces almost the entire agricultural population into the hands of the native moneylenders, from whom alone money to meet the tax can be obtained. And then we hypocritically lament the usurious disposition of the men who lend on the crops. When it is remembered that for every improvement which a peasant makes in his holding he is taxed for, That fallow land in British territory is taxed as high as cultivated land, and that little allowance is made for famine periods. It is easy to comprehend the crushing effect of our ruinous system upon the miserable agriculturists, who constitute 4/5 of the Indian population. But for the moneylenders, the government of India would at once be bankrupt. And Hyman pursued, the reason for this continuous depletion of wealth and that destruction of well-being is not far to seek. And this reason applies to the entire population under British control. Here, at any rate, race, color or religion makes no difference. All are subject to the same terrible disadvantage of the drain of produce away from India on the English account, without any commercial returns. This drain of economic tribute, from which most conquered dependencies suffer, is especially severe in the case of India. Making every possible allowance, it is established that, comparing Indian exports and Indian imports, the overplus of exports, for which there is no commercial return, now amounts to more than 35 million sterling a year, or considerably in excess of 50% more than the total land revenue obtained from all of British India. This drain has been going on in an increasing ratio, and necessarily with deepening effects ever since the British occupation. It means that India, naturally a country with the greatest possibilities for wealth production in every department, is being steadily bled to death in order to pay pensions, interests, home charges, dividends and remittances in Great Britain to the capitalist and landlord classes with their hammers on. Wherever it is possible to throw a charge up on the Indian revenue, this is at once done. And as the Indians are wholly unrepresented in India or in Great Britain, they are unable to complain effectively in any way. When to this drain of 35 million annually is added the amount paid for the services of Europeans in India, including the 75,000 white soldiers, which run up to many more million sterling, it is clear we need look no farther for the real causes of India's frightful impoverishment and the continuous famine and plague which now steadily prevail in some part or other of that territory. End quote. Or for any other explanation, that even by the most optimistic modern estimates, the cross-national product per capita of India remained at best stagnant from 1750 to 1880 and then dropped by 20% to 1920. However much the British constantly exclaimed they were developing India by building canals or railroads. Those, of course, primarily served to grow cotton, grain or tea for Britain and to transport it there. Or that they were developing India by introducing that magnificent, transparent Anglo-Saxon system of law, in which judges in India, by the most cautious estimates, condemned at least 10,000 people to floggings, that is legalized torture, a year. Or in which that great liberal savvy, Thomas Babington Macaulay, had provided that people could be put in preventive detention, that is detained without having to produce evidence, if there might be a danger to the state for up to 2 years, or again, where the British Empire had its own gulag for shipping political prisoners. First the Seychelles Islands, later on the Andaman Islands. And then, of course, there were all the grand accomplishments of the British in providing a good education, so that in 1900 some 5% of Englishmen were illiterate, and 87% of India's population. But then there were, argued Digby in 1900, two Indians. There was the Anglo-Star, the land especially ruled by the English, in which English investments were by and large concentrated and by which a fair show of prosperity was maintained. The India of the British expatriates there. And it was the India that the average British visitor saw too. It was the India of the Presidency towns, of the railway stations or of the hill stations. It was the picture book Raj for short. And that was what all the roseate statements of the British administration habitually referred to as well. For that Anglo-Stan was indeed a marvel of governing skill and ability. And there was the Hindustan of 100 million starving peasants that was only referred to in the margins or in the sidelines by the administration. And Anglo-Stan and its roseate statements is what an entire sentimental historic literature before or since has also most loved to dwell. Tony Blair was recently only under severe pressure brought to scrap a face in a speech in which he said he was proud of the British Empire. Yet as Cambridge historian Richard Drayton put it, we hear a lot about the rule of law, incorruptible government and economic progress about the British Empire in 1800, in 1900, or indeed in 2016. Yet the reality was tyranny, oppression, poverty and unnecessary death of countless millions of human beings. In other words, what the historians now like to call the great divergence between a rich West and an impoverished Africa and Asia was primarily wrought by colonialism in the 19th century, and that development of underdevelopment, as economist André Gunther Frankie used to call it, was partly to benefit Manchester or the city's elites. And it was exactly what the economic orthodoxy commanded as the wise thing to do besides. For no one, wrote economist John Cairns in 1860, can have studied political economy in the works of its earlier cultivators without being struck with the dreariness of the outlook which, in the main, they disclosed for the human race. It seems to have been Ricardo's deliberate opinion that a substantial improvement in the condition of the masses of mankind was completely impossible. That, of course, meant the working classes, rather than those city speculators where Ricardo belonged. Now, this current scientific consensus was simply taken over by Marx as what became known as his immiseration thesis. Marx argued that, in accordance with Ricardo's labor theory of value, capitalist competition would necessitate the gradual replacement of workers with machines, allowing an increase in productivity. But with less overall value for each good produced, as more products can be made in a given amount of time, so that the economic output would increase, but real wages would remain stable, as the input of human labor stays the same. Yet Marx also noted that this movement is not merely an abstract relation, but is a result of the class struggle, and could be stopped should wages dip below an amount that the proletariat deemed acceptable. There have been few theories which have been so derided as that immiseration theory. That real wages began to rise in England after 1860, in Western Europe in the 1870s, and in immigration countries such as the USA, Australia or Canada increased throughout the 19th century, is generally considered a supreme proof this entire theory, and indeed Marx's entire system, is wrong. Now, the reason why wages in immigration countries increased are pretty obvious. Had these countries not been perpetually short of labor, and thus the employees being in a particularly strong position vis-à-vis their employers, so that they could ask high wages, they would not have needed to attract immigrants. As to the wages in Europe, the immiseration theory is a schoolbook case of not so much a self-fulfilling as of a self-denying prophecy. The prime reason wages in Europe rose was not because the employers decided that so much, but because of the militancy of the workers' unions, which were very much organized by Marx's own international labor movement. After all, next to the vote, it primarily campaigned for higher wages and a shorter labor day. And at no time, since or before, was worker militancy probably so high as in the late 19th century, when likely hundreds of thousands of hours were lost in strikes, and the army all over Europe routinely engaged in strike breaking, while the governments had repeatedly to intervene to force to pay higher wages, lest they had the revolution on their hands everybody was then afraid of. In other words, the immiseration has not occurred in Europe very much because of Karl Marx. Yet the colonies are a very different story. As both the British Indian and the Dutch East Indies colonial administration acknowledged, while both wages and living standards in Europe were improving, in India and Indonesia they were rapidly deteriorating in the late 19th century. Both governments published lots of hearings and anguished reports about all that. And they then pretty much left it at that too. The British Empire was the place on which the sun never set and the wages never rose, as economist Elise Marston sums it up very well. And much as any improvement of the lot of the masses was both impossible and undesirable, so too, following the economic orthodoxy, the president of the Board of Trade, Lord Salisbury, denounced it a species of international communism that a rich Britain should penalize her trade for the benefit of a poor India. This was partly the Manchester or City lobby speaking, yet it was to some extent inherent to parliamentary democracy as well, since the average British voter, and the working class voter least of all, would not brook that even a single taxpayer's penny was ever spent on anything that did not directly benefit him, whereas the sole function of colonies was to provide material benefits or employ to Englishmen or Dutch and Frenchmen, for that matter. For, as the Honourable Member of Parliament Earl Winterton noted in 1896, a proposal to vote a single penny on a colony or dependency was always met with an outburst by the opposition members below the gangway. An empire was all nice and well, yet any charity should begin at home, as the honorable parliamentarians used to say, and it better stay there too. And they were voicing merely the opinion of their constituencies here. If there was one thing likely to anger the Victorian public, it were heavy expenditure on empire, as Robinson and Kelleher sums its attitude up. Now, partly simply because of its vast size, which meant that however poor most of its inhabitants, it still had a vast internal market, and partly since there was comparatively little virgin and jungle land available to establish plantations. Partly too, since the British simply trod in the footsteps of the Mughals, who had already raised taxes in cash. And finally, since the Raj did not have good experience with plantations, as the terrible conditions on indigo plantations in Bengal in the late 50s had led to a very dangerous revolt, India was still in many ways an exceptional colony. And that was so in three ways. First, However much the British tried to encourage exports to Britain, exports were on aggregate still comparatively unimportant for the Indian economy. In 1900, they accounted for about 6% of India's gross national product, whereas in the common colony, mostly heavily reliant on exports, such as the Gold Coast, that was 32%, and in Malaysia it was 40%. Second, though the importance of custom revenues to the total budget of British India rose in the late 19th century, its prime source of state revenue were taxes in cash levied on land, where the British more or less took over the pre-existing system of taxation. In contrast, in most of Africa, cash was entirely unknown, although in West Africa, cowrie shells had long circulated as a kind of small coin, so that as the population had no cash, it was also impossible to levy taxes in it. Ideally, colonial officials there forced inhabitants to do forced labor a couple of days for which they were ideally paid in cash. And in that way, they could pay their hut tax. Yet since there was so little money, it was often more expensive to collect the hut tax than it ever yielded. Consequently, colonial governments in Africa tended to heavily or only rely on custom revenues, a persistent trend in Africa to the present. Hence too, they tended to encourage mines and plantations, whereas both developed rather slowly in India. And third, while from the mid-19th century onwards, the Raj started to allot some money to education, particularly a higher education that was to train subordinate officials, the bulk of the money was spent on the army. In the early 19th century, the Raj spent virtually its entire budget on the army, and in 1900 that was still 30%, far more than it spent on education. Thus, first and foremost, the Raj was England's barrack in the East, from which it could draw troops to subjugate other countries. That percentage was similar to Russia's, and for the collection of these, the Raj, despite its constant insistence the government spent as little as possible, maintained the world's second largest bureaucracy, after Russia again. That Tsarist autocracy, which that autocracy of the British Viceroys indeed most closely resembled. In contrast, most other colonial states had minimal governments. The total administrative staff of the British colony of the Gold Coast was, for example, less than 500 persons. Now, if India was exceptional, the typical colonial economy was, according to historian Anthony Hopkins, an open economy. It exported a very limited range of agricultural or mineral products, dominated by expatriate interests, with low tariffs and minimal restrictions on trade. Other features were an unwillingness of the metropolis to shoulder any of the fiscal burdens of running a colony, and a monetary system which was no more than an appendage of that of its colonial master. And finally, what the Dutch colonial economist Jan Boeke called a dualist economy in the 1930s. That entailed on the one hand a small subsistence agriculture, in which the overwhelming mass of the native population, on the other, large-scale mining and plantations that, as Boeke put it, were organized in such a fashion that they did not necessitate anything more of the colony than cheap land and labor, while they had isolated themselves from the population as much as possible. From any further capacities of them than menial labor, from any further achievements of them, or from their views and interests, so that to the natives they had created an atmosphere of exploitation from incomprehensible distance. Those mines and plantations were controlled by expatriate companies, mostly from the metropolis, though in some colonies British and American companies also played a major role, and they worked exclusively for exports. With the major exception of those of the settlement colonies, colonial governments, colonial official and scholar James Furnival wrote, followed the principle of the management of a factory rather than the government of a country. Their main aim was to attain certain production targets rather than caring for the good of their subjects, and if they did so, that was only to heighten production. Whilst if they might allow people from the shop floor a say in the management, that was their ultimate objective as well. Or, as historian Claudine Cott writes about the French, quote, "The average colonial official was the archetypical paternalist who would talk the whole time about my roads, my natives, my district. And yet he always knew in his heart that his promotion depended on yields, on tax revenues, on numbers of forced laborers or of cash crops. For example, in the 1,000-year-old kingdom of Burma, the British had in 1885 deposed its final king of the Kumbang dynasty, Thibaw, and had submitted Burma to British India. They put the palace of the Kumbang in the then already legendary town of Mandalay on fire. They dragged the lion's throne of the king to the Indian Museum of Calcutta and put the garrison Fort Dufferin in its place. Burma was, some observers at the time argued, perhaps the happiest country in the world before the British came there. There was no aristocracy, no priesthood, no state church, no army, no poverty, no castes, no nobles, no great landowners, and no bankers. There followed a further decade of bloody pacification against tough peasant resistance. But with the final suppression thereof came all the common blessings of colonial British improvement. Engineers, money and banks, moneylenders, steamers, post offices, as well as a European business community who established the tone of this government. Laissez-faire, strong police control, easy money, and an abundant Indian labor force. While they had, and preferred to have, as few contact with Burmese as possible, and to return home as possible too. And from the colonial logic, perceiving a country in terms of its output, Burma was a striking success. For with the reclamation of the so far thinly populated Irrawaddy Delta, Burma turned into a monoculture. What Canada or the American Midwest was for grain, Burma was for rice. The area under cultivation from 860 to 1926 expanded eightfold, the total production sixfold, and of Burma's total rice production, 64% was exported in 1910 and 62% in 1930, and those exports were exclusively controlled by European firms. And from its export surpluses, Burma could subsidize the government of British India as well. Meanwhile, however, the per capita production of rice dropped by a third from 1880 to 1940, and per capita consumption to one-fourth of its 1880 level. In other words, Burmese rice-growing peasants had steadily less rice to eat, while the production of their land was siphoned off to India or Britain. Yet the opening of the Irrawaddy was, unlike that of the American or Canadian prairies, not accomplished by prosperous tenant farmers, as rather by utterly destitute small peasants from the upland of Burma. It took 3 to 4 years to bring land under bullocks. They might famish in the meantime and often had to get heavily in debt. The delta was particularly infested with malaria, so most of them were most of the time sick, While on the jungle fringes, there was not only the threat of leopards and tigers, but of wild elephants that could trample both the crops and their dwellings. Nonetheless, ever more people moved into the delta to perhaps purchase with their hard-earned cash a few pieces of textiles, a kerosene lamp or a clock. And above all, they were driven by the dream of cultivating their own land after a couple of years. Meanwhile, ever more Indians immigrated to Burma. 60% of them came from southern India and 30% came from neighboring Bengal, for the rice milling industry far preferred Indians to Burmese. Coming from the poorest districts of India, those coolies were willing to labor long hours at arduous, monotonous and dangerous work, were rated as submissive and easy to control, and got paid half the salary of a Burmese worker. They were housed in unsanitary barracks on the bigger mills, or in cheap pensions, 20 to 30 coolies to a room. In 1890, there were 400,000 Indians in Burma. In 1931, there were 1 million, and in Rangoon, there were the majority. They were as much likely to be washermen, owners of roadside cafes or water drawers, as by the 20s, professional men and merchants. Though most Indians were even poorer than the Burmese, there were bankers of the South Indian Chettiar caste among them too, who followed the British flag to Malaysia, yet Burma became their special field, with branch offices by 1910 distributed in every provincial town, and with Burmese cultivators not having access to European banks, the Chettiar financed the expansion of rice cultivation. Yet by 1920, the delta got into ever severe problems. Land that was easily cleared was almost spent. By 1930, 75% of the peasants was severely in debt, and some 20% of the land had become property of landlords, and a further 8% of the Chettiar, who one Karen peasant typified as fiery dragons that parch every land that has the misfortune of coming under their wicked creepings. And so, as Furnival put it, thus the epic of bravery and endurance, relating the greatest achievement in the history of Burma, the reclamation by Burmese enterprise 10 million acres of swamp and jungle, ends with a picture of imposing government offices and business houses in Rangoon, and kill the Chettiar temple while in the rice districts, the sources of all this wealth. Nearly half the land is owned by foreigners, and the landless people can show nothing for their labor but their debts, and for about half a year, most of them are unable to find work or wages. Now, as Morris underlined, the inner logic of capitalism was on the one hand to constantly create new needs to sell new products, whether that be tea and coffee in the 18th century or mobile phones or iPads nowadays, and thus too a constant need for raw materials to manufacture those new products, such as the rare earth used for mobile phones that is presently only mined in China. Or, in the 19th century, there was margarine, invented by French chemist Hippolyte Mache-Mourier in the 1860s as a cheap substitute for butter for the working classes. Margarine was made from vegetable oil, and it was made from palm oil very much in particular, and that created a feverish demand for palm. Now, one of the main areas supplying that palm was the Blight of Benin, the trade of which increased rapidly by the 1860s, and that led to constant friction between the French and the British traders there, one of whom was George Troutman Coldy, exiled by his parents as a last resort to distant West Africa, as he had the tendency to first fall in love with and then make pregnant one servant girl after another, whom, in 1879, to standard French competition had merged the three rival British companies into a single monopoly organization, the National Africa Company. And Colby argued that, quote, with old established markets closing in on our trade everywhere, it would be suicidal to abandon to our rival power, France, the only developed opening for our trade. For the scramble for Africa and the age of modern imperialism took place in the middle of a bad economic recession, so British merchants and industrialists saw their markets in Europe dwindle due to the recession as much as to ever more severe German competition, and due to increasingly shoddy British workmanship as well, very much due to such colonial captive markets as India, where the colonials had to buy British goods whether they wanted them or not. To open this yet virgin market, Colley's plan was to monopolize the entire trade of the Niger for himself and for his company, provided the British government provided him with a charter by way of exclusive or preemptive treaties with local rulers. Treaties by which they were prohibited to deal with anybody but Colby. This charter was granted by Westminster in 1886, and it allowed Colby to arrange his own small paramilitary empire from his headquarters at Asaba, 60 kilometers from Benin City, including its own court of justice, and its 460 men, drawn not from the uncivilized Afik, whom everybody still dreaded, as rather from the more civilized parts of Africa, such as Fanti from Cape Coast or Creoles from Freetown. Pledges from him and the British diplomats that free trade would always be respected in the National African Company's territory were completely dead letters. Its over 400 treaties with local leaders forced them to trade solely with or through the company's agents. When King Jaya of Opobo organized his own trading network and even began to running his own shipments of palm oil to Britain, he was lured onto a British warship and shipped into exile to the Caribbean island of St. Vincent on charges of treaty breaking and obstructing commerce. Huge tariffs and license fees eliminated competing firms from the area. Those private contracts were next made into general treaties by the British consul, mostly without consulting the signatory. In other words, while kings or chiefs had signed treaties with Colby, in which his people would deliver them so many casks with spirits, the main item traded on the coast, in return for so many calabashes with palm oil, they now found themselves titled subjects of Queen Victoria, because they had cited treaties that, according to the English law, as it was now interpreted by the Colonial Office, made them to legal subjects. So that Colby clamored for armed support, sent in 1897 under Sergeant Frederick Lucar, who had already made quite a name for himself by both his skillful handling of very similar treaties in Uganda as much as of the Maxime Gun. Yet Colby still complained about French competition and duplicity of local rulers, and it was evidently impossible for a chartered company to hold its own against the state-supported protectorates of France and Germany. In consequence, its charter was revoked, and on the 1st of January 1900, the Royal Niger Company sold its territories to the British government for the sum of 865,000 sterling. The ceded territory, together with the small Niger Protectorate, Lagos and surroundings, already under imperial control, was then formed into the two protectorates of northern and southern Nigeria, a new name invented by journalist Gloria Shaw, Lucas' mistress and later wife, after the old name Oil Rivers had been rejected as being too commercial in nature, and the name Coldonia, that many would have preferred, as a bit presumptuous. Cody lived on to ripe old age, being awarded a baronetcy and an honorary doctorate of Cambridge University. And the Royal African Company could devote itself to trade, till it was acquired in 1920 by William Lever, manager of the Unilever concern, that, with that too, brought more than 75% of all the exports of Nigeria, so that, it is but fair to say, Nigeria is ultimately a creation of Unilever. In fact, since the various companies to which the exploitation, in any sense of the word, of Africa was entrusted, all still exist, or have been merged into various giant modern transnational corporations, I might equally well say Tanzania is a creation of the Deutsche Bank. The Democratic Republic of Congo, of the Société Générale Group, the main financier of the Congo Society. Its neighbor, the Republic of Congo, is a creation of the Banque de Paris et des Pays-Bas, much as is Gabon, and Zambia and Zimbabwe are both creations of the Beer Diamonds. Two further cases of how Africans were cajoled participants in the world market as Morris intended. In the French Ivory Coast, inhabitants in 1908, if not actively, then still passively, resisted the colonial authority. There were still rebels hiding in the forests everywhere, and African priests bitterly resented and resisted the French. The area was reputed as dangerous, so no French company wanted to invest there, and the government, relying on its tariffs on exports, was broke. The new governor, Gabriel Anglouffant, tackled these problems vigorously. Chiefs and priests who dared objecting to the French were banished or imprisoned, and his troops scorched entire districts. In Yamoussoukro, after the pacification of 400 villages, only 40 were left. The villagers had henceforth to pay their hut taxes and cultivate coca for export. Anglouffant's policy surely benefited exports, yet the inhabitants perhaps less. In 1904, the Ivory Coast had merely exported 4 tons of coca. In 1913, already 1,178, and the entire economy of the Ivory Coast got completely, dangerously dependent on that single staple product. Second case, Charles Lemaire, beginning a long career in the Belgian Congo, had his first independent posting in the Equatorial province. He declared to the population he was the emissary of Bula Matari, and that the ones who would not follow him could expect war. Lemaire introduced forced labor, and if villagers would not deliver laborers, they would be heavily fined. Whilst they had to deliver rubber, food and ivory quota, and could expect punitary rates if they would not comply. 1898, for example, Irabou district was attacked by Lemaire. "We torched every single village," Lemaire wrote later on, "except two owned by the missionaries. 50 natives were left dead as we parted." The population of Equatoria nicknamed him either Mamyanta, Palaver or Death, or Dikoka, the shooter. But Lemaire soon surely excelled at his work, as Equatoria became one of the main suppliers of rubber to the world market. The population called it the Green Inferno. So, as Albert Schweitzer wrote, and arguably predicted in 1921, if the Africans could live by and for themselves, we should leave them for themselves. It is, however, a fact that world trade has penetrated these areas to such an extent that the clock cannot be turned back. Through world trade, they have lost their freedom. The economic and social conditions under which these people lived have been destroyed. And the inevitable consequence has been that the chiefs, using the weapons and the money that commerce has placed at their disposal, have reduced most of their people to servitude and turned them into slaves, who must work for the benefit of a small minority that controls the export trade. Still today, the harms we inflict on Africans should not be passed over in silence or concealed. Yet, to grant independence to these countries now would merely result in exploitation by their own countrymen, and would no longer make up for our own failures.